We woke to darkness. The temperature had plummeted, so we pulled on our heavy cold suits. They were made from the same radiation-blocking material as our tent. But with thermal lining and piezoelectric heating elements, so that if we kept moving, we could keep warm. The visored hoods had vents with micro-louvers to let us breathe, hear, and speak without losing too much body heat.
What about the dog? Amal asked. We don't have a cold suit for her.
Edie immediately set to work cutting up some of the extra fabric we had brought for patching things. Amal tried to help her wrap it around Sally and secure it with tape, but the dog thought it was a game, and as their dog wrestling grew desperate, they ended up collapsing in laughter. I left the tent to look after Bucky, and when I next saw Sally, she looked like a dog mummy with only her eyes and nose poking through.
I'll do something better when we stop next, Edie pledged.
The next 10 hours was a slow, dark trudge through icy stromatolite bogs. When the water froze solid enough to support the buggy, we cut across it to reach the edge of the mazy lakes, pushing on past our normal camping time. Once on solid land, we were quick to set up the tent and the propane stove to heat it. Everyone crowded inside, eager to shed their cold suits. Taking off a cold suit at the end of the day is like emerging from a stifling womb, ready to breathe free. After lights out, I was already asleep when Seabird nudged me.
There's something moving outside, she whispered.
No, there's not, I muttered. She was always worried that we were deviating from plan or losing our way or not keeping to schedule. I turned over to go back to sleep when Sally growled. Something hit the roof of the tent. It sounded like a small branch falling from a tree, but there were no trees where we had camped.
Did you hear that? Seabird hissed.
Okay. I'll check it out. It was hard to leave my snug sleep cocoon and pull on the cold suit again, but better me than her, since she would probably imagine things and wake everyone. It was the coldest part of night, and there was a slight frost of dry ice on the rocks around us. Everything in the landscape was motionless. Above, the galaxy arched, a frozen cloud of light. I shone my lamp on the tent to see what had hit it, but there was nothing. All was still. In the eastern sky, a dim, gray smudge of light was rising over the lakes. Umber. I did not stare long, not quite trusting the UV shielding on my faceplate, but I didn't like the look of it. I had never read that the shroud began to glow before it parted, but the observations from the last umber night were not detailed, and there were none from the time before that. Still, I crawled back into the safety of the tent, feeling troubled.
What was it?
Seabird whispered. Nothing. She would think that was an invasion, so I added, if anything was out there, I scared it off. When we rose, I left the tent first with the UV detector. The night was still just as dark, but there was no longer a glow in the east, and the increase of radiation was not beyond the usual fluctuations. Nevertheless, I quietly mentioned what I had seen to Amal.
Are you sure it's significant?
He said. I wasn't sure of anything, so I shook my head.
I'm not going to call off the mission unless we're sure.
I probably would have made the same decision. At the time, there was no telling whether it was wise or foolish. Bucky was cold after sitting for 10 hours, and we had barely started when a spring in his suspension broke. It took me an hour to fix it, working awkwardly in my bulky cold suit, but we finally set off. We had come to the Damrite Barrens, a rocky plateau full of the ejecta from the ancient meteor strike that had created Newton's Eye. The farther we walked,
the more rugged it became, and in the dark, it was impossible to see ahead and pick out the best course. Devern gave a piteous howl of pain, and we all came to a stop. He had turned his ankle. There was no way to examine it without setting up the tent, so Amal took some of the load from the buggy and carried it so Devern could ride. After another 6 hours of struggling through the boulders, I suggested we camp and wait for daybreak. "We're ahead of schedule," I said. "It's wiser to wait than to risk breaking something important."
"My ankle's not important,"
Devern protested. "Your ankle will heal. Bucky's axle won't." Sulkily, he said,
"You ought to marry that machine. You care more for it than any person."
I would have answered, but I saw Edie looking at me in warning, and I knew she would give him a talking to later on. When we finally got a look at Davern's ankle inside the tent, it was barely swollen, and I suspected him of malingering for sympathy, but rather than have him slow us down, we all agreed to let him ride till it got better. Day came soon after we had slept. We tackled the dam right again, moving much faster now that we could see the path. I made them push on till we came to the edge of the winding wall. Coming on the winding wall is exhilarating or terrifying, depending on your personality. At the end of an upward slope, the world drops suddenly away, leaving you on the edge of sky. Standing on the windy precipice, you have to lean forward to see the cliffs plunging nearly perpendicular to the basin of the crater, 300 meters below. To right and left, the cliff edge undulates in a snaky line that forms a huge arc, vanishing into the distance, for the crater circle is far too wide to see across. "I always wish for wings here," I said, as we lined the edge, awestruck.
"How are we going to get down?" Edie asked.
"There's a way, but it's treacherous. Best to do it fresh." "We've got 30 hours of light left," Amal said.
"Then let's rest up."
It was noon when we rose, and umber had set. I led the way to the spot where a ravine pierced the wall. Unencumbered by cold suits, we were far more agile, but Bucky still had only 4 wheels and no legs. We unloaded him in order to use the cart bed as a ramp, laying it over the rugged path so he could pass, and ferrying the baggage by hand, load after load. Davern was forced to go by foot when it got too precarious, using a tent pole for a cane. It was hard, sweaty work, but 12 hours later, we were at the bottom, feeling triumphant. We piled into the tent and slept until dark. The next leg of the journey was an easy one, over the sandy plain of the crater floor. Through the dark, we walked, then slept, walked, then slept, until we started seeing steam venting from the ground as we reached the geothermically active region at the center of the crater. Here we came on the remains of an old road built by the original settlers when they expected to be staying at Newton's Eye. It led through the hills of the inner crater ring. When we paused at the top of the rise, I noticed the same smudge of light in the sky I'd seen before. This time, I immediately took a UV reading, and the levels had spiked. I showed it to Amal. "The shroud's thinning," I said. I couldn't read his expression through the faceplate of his cold suit, but his body language was all indecision.
"Let's take another reading in a couple hours," he said.
We did, but there was no change. We were moving fast by now, through a landscape formed by old eruptions. Misshapen claws of lava reached out of the darkness on either side, frozen in the act of menacing the road. At last, we were thinking of stopping. We spied ahead the shape of towering ribs against the stars, the remains of the settlers' original landing craft, or the parts of it too big to cannibalize. With our goal so close, we pushed on till we came to the cleared plain where it lay,
the fossil skeleton of a monster that once swam the stars. We all stood gazing at it, reluctant to approach and shatter its isolation.
"Why don't we camp here?" Edie said.
We had made better time than I had expected. The plan had been to arrive just as the cargo capsule did, pick up the payload, and head back immediately. But we were a full 20 hours early. We could afford to rest. I woke before the others, pulled on my protective gear, and went outside to see the dawn. The eastern sky glowed a cold pink and azure. The landing site was a basin of black volcanic rock. Steaming pools of water made milky with dissolved silicates dappled the plain, smelling of sodium bicarbonate. As I watched the day come, the pools turned the same startling blue as the sky, set like turquoise and jet. The towering ribs of the lander now stood out in the strange, desolate landscape. I thought of all the sunrises they had seen. Each one a passing fragment of time, a shard of a millennium, in which this one was just a nanosecond of nothing. Behind me, boots crunched on cinders. I turned to see that Amal had joined me. He didn't greet me, just stood taking in the scene. At last he said,
"It's uplifting, isn't it?"
Startled, I said, "What is?"
"That they came all this way for the sake of reason."
Came all this way to a desolation of rock and erosion stretching to the vanishing point. No, uplifting was not a word I would use, but I didn't say so. He went back to the tent to fetch the others, and soon I was surrounded by youthful energy that made me despise my own sclerotic disaffection. They all wanted to go explore the ruins, so I waved them on and returned to the tent to fix my breakfast. After eating, I went to join them. I found Seabird and Davern bathing in one of the hot pools, shaded by an awning constructed from their cold suits. "You're sure of the chemicals in that water, are you?" I asked.
"Oh, stop worrying," Davern said. "You're just a walking death's head, Mick. You see danger everywhere."
Ahead, the other three were clustered under the shadow of the soaring ship ribs. When I came up, I saw they had found a stone monument and were standing silently before it, the hoods of their cold suits thrown back. Sally sat at Edie's feet.
"It's a memorial to everyone who died in the first year," Edie told me in a hushed voice.
"But that's not the important part,"
Anatoly said intently. He pointed to a line of the inscription, a quotation from Theodore Cam, the legendary leader of the exiles. It said, "Gaze into the unknowable from a bridge of evidence."
"You see," Anatoly said, "he knew there was something unknowable. Reason doesn't reach all the way. There are other truths. We were right. There's more to the universe than just the established facts."
I thought back to Feynman Habitat and how the pursuit of knowledge had contracted into something rigid and dogmatic. No wonder my generation had failed to inspire. I looked up at the skeleton of the spacecraft making its grand, useless gesture to the sky. How could mere reason compete with that? After satisfying my curiosity, I trudged back to the tent. From a distance, I heard a whining sound, and when I drew close, I realized it was coming from Bucky. Puzzled, I rummaged through his load to search for the source. When I realized what it was, my heart pulsed in panic. Instantly, I put up the hood on my cold suit and ran to warn the others.
"Put on your cold suits and get back to the tent," I shouted at Seabird and Davern. "Our X-ray detector went off. The shroud has parted." Umber was invisible in the bright daylight of the western sky, but a pulse of X-rays could only mean one thing. When I had rounded them all up and gotten them back to the shielded safety of the tent, we held a council. "We've got to turn around and go back this instant," I said. There was a long silence. I turned to Amal. "You promised."
"I promised we'd turn back if Umber Knight came on our way out," he said. "We're not on the way out any longer. We're here, and it's only 10 hours before the capsule arrives. We'd be giving up in the sight of success."
10 hours for the capsule to come, another 10 to get it unpacked and reload on Bucky," I pointed out. "If we're lucky."
"But Umber sets soon," Edie pointed out. "We'll be safe till it rises again."
I had worked it all out. "By that time, we'll barely be back to the winding wall. We have to go up that path this time, bathed in X-rays."
"Our cold suits will shield us," Anatoly said. "It will be hard, but we can do it."
The trip up to now had been too easy. It had given them inflated confidence. Anatoly looked around at the others, his face fierce and romantic, with a shadow of black beard accentuating his jawline.
"I've realized now, what we're doing really matters. We're not just fetching baggage. We're a link to the settlers. We have to live up to their standards, to their heroism."
He said the last word as if it were unfamiliar, as indeed it was in the crabbed pragmatism of Feynman habitat. I could see a contagion of inspiration spreading through them. Only I was immune.
"They died," I said. 2/3 of them. Didn't you read that monument?"
"They didn't know what we do," Amal argued. "They weren't expecting Umber Knight."
Anatoly saw I was going to object and spoke first.
"Maybe some of us will die too. Maybe that's the risk we need to take. They were willing, and so am I."
He was noble, committed, and utterly serious.
"No one wants you to die."
I couldn't keep the frustration from my voice.
"Your dying would be totally useless. It would only harm the rest of us. You need to live. Sorry to break it to you."
They were all caught up in the kind of crazy courage that brought the settlers here. They all felt the same devotion to a cause, and they hadn't yet learned that the universe doesn't give a rip.
"Listen," I said. "You've got to ask yourself, what's a win here? Dying is not a win. Living is a win, even if it means living with failure."
As soon as I said the last word, I could see it was the wrong one.
"Let's vote," said Amal. "Devern, what about you? You haven't said anything."
Devern looked around at the others, and I could see he was sizing up who to side with.
"I'm with Anatoly," he said. "He understands us."
Amal nodded, as if this made sense.
"How about you, Seabird?"
She looked up at Anatoly with what I first thought was admiration. Then I realized it was infatuation.
"I'll follow Anatoly," she said with feeling.
The followers in our group had chosen Anatoly as their leader.
"I vote with Anatoly too," said Amal. "I think we've come this far. It would be crazy to give up now. Edie?"
"I respect Mick's advice," she said thoughtfully. "But our friends back home are counting on us. And in a way, the settlers are counting on us too. All those people died so we could be here. And to give up would be like letting them down."
I pulled up the hood of my cold suit and headed out of the tent. Outside, the day was bright and poisonous, The cold suit shielded me from the X-rays, but not from the feeling of impending disaster. I looked across to the skeletal shipwreck and wondered, what are we doing here on Dust? The settlers chose this, but none of us asked to be born here, exiled from the rest of humanity, like the scum on the sand left by the highest wave. We aren't noble pioneers. We're only different from the bacteria because we are able to ask what the hell this is all about. Not answer, just ask. Someone came out of the tent behind me, and I looked to see who it was this time. Edie. She came to my side.
Mick, we are so thankful that you're with us, she said. We do listen to you. We just agreed to go to a 12-hour work shift on the way back, to speed things up. We'll get back.
I truly wished she weren't here. She was the kind of person who ought to be protected, so she could continue to bring cheer to the world. She was too valuable to be thrown away. It's not about me, I said. I've got less life to lose than the rest of you.
No one's going to lose their lives, she said. I promise.
Why can't I quit asking what more I could have done? I'm tired of that question. I still don't know what else there was to do. 10 hours later, there was no sign of the supply ship. Everyone was restless. We had slept and risen again, and now we scanned the skies every few minutes, hoping to see something. Edie looked up from fashioning little dog goggles and said,
Do you suppose it's landed somewhere else?
Once she had voiced the idea, it became our greatest worry. What if our assumption about the landing spot was wrong? We told ourselves it was just that the calculations had been off, or the ship was making an extra orbit. Now that we had made the commitment to stay, no one wanted to give up. But how long were we prepared to wait? In the end, we could not have missed the lander's descent. It showed up first as a bright spot in the western sky. Then it became a fiery streak, and we saw the parachutes bloom. Seconds later, landing rockets fired. We cheered as, with a roar that shook the ground, the craft set down in a cloud of dust, barely a kilometer from us. As the warm wind buffeted us, even I felt that the sight had been worth the journey. By the time we had taken down the tent, loaded everything on Bucky, and raced over to the landing site, the dust had settled and the metal cooled. It was almost sunset, so we worked fast in the remaining light. One team unloaded everything from Bucky, while another team puzzled out how to open the cargo doors. The inside of the spacecraft was tightly packed with molded plastic cases we couldn't work out how to open, so we just piled them onto the buggy as they came out. We would leave the thrill of discovery to our friends back home. Bucky was dangerously overloaded before we had emptied the pod, so we reluctantly secured the doors with some of the crates still inside to stay the winter at Newton's Eye. We could only hope that we had gotten the most important ones. There was still a lot of work to do, sorting out our baggage and redistributing it, and we worked by lamplight into the night. By the time all was ready, we were exhausted. Umber had not yet risen, so there was no need to set up the tent, and we slept on the ground in the shadow of the lander. I was so close that I could reach out and touch something that had come all the way from the home world. We set out into the night as soon as we woke. Bucky creaked and groaned, but I said encouraging words to him, and he seemed to get used to his new load. All of us were more heavily laden now, and the going would have been slower, even if Bucky could have kept up his usual pace. When we reached the top of the inner crater ring, we paused to look back at the plain, where two spacecraft now stood. In the silence of our tribute,
the X-ray alarm went off. Invisible through our UV screening faceplates, Umber was rising in the east. Umber night was ahead. We walked in silence. Sally hung close to us in her improvised cold suit, no longer roving and exploring. From time to time, she froze in her tracks and gave a low growl. But nothing was there.
"What's she growling at? X-rays?" Anatoly said.
"She's just picking up tension from us," Edie said, reaching down to pat the dog's back.
Half a mile later, Sally lunged forward, snapping at the air as if to bite it. Through the cloth of her cold suit, she could not have connected with anything, even if anything had been there.
"Now I'm picking up on her tension," Davern said.
"Ouch! Who did that?"
Seabird cried out, clutching her arm.
"Somebody hit me."
"Everyone calm down," Edie said. "Look around you. There's nothing wrong."
She shone her lamp all around, and she was right. The scene looked exactly as it had when we had traversed it before. A barren, volcanic plain, pocked with steaming vents and the occasional grove of ever-live trees. The deadly radiation was invisible. Another mile further on, Amal swore loudly and slapped his thigh as if bitten by a fly. He bent over to inspect his cold suit and swore again.
"Something pierced my suit," he said. "There's 3 pinholes in it."
Sally started barking. We shone our lights everywhere, but could see nothing. It was like being surrounded by malicious poltergeists that had gathered to impede our journey. I quieted the dog and said, "Everyone stop and listen." At first, I heard nothing but my own heart. Then, as we kept still, it came. A rustling of unseen movement in the dark all around us.
"We've got company," Anatoly said grimly.
I wanted to deny my senses. For years, I had been searching for animal life on dust and found none. Not even an insect, other than the ones we brought. And how could anything be alive in this bath of radiation? It was scientifically impossible. We continued on more carefully. After a while, I turned off my headlamp and went out in front to see if I could see anything without the glare of the light. At first, there was nothing. But as my eyes adjusted, something snagged my attention out of the corner of my eye. It was a faint, gauzy curtain, a net hanging in the air, glowing a dim blue-gray. It was impossible to tell how close it was, just before my face or over the next hill. I swept my arm out to disturb it, but touched nothing. So either it was far away, or it was inside my head. Something slapped my faceplate, and I recoiled. There was a smear of goo across my visor. I tried to wipe it off, and an awful smell from my breathing vent nearly gagged me. Behind me, Amal gave an exclamation, and I thought he had smelled it too. But when I turned to see, he was looking at his foot.
"I stepped on something," he said. "I could feel it crunch."
"What's that disgusting smell?" Davern said.
"Something slimed me," I answered.
"Keep on going, everyone," Edie said. "We can't stop to figure it out."
We plodded on, a slow herd surrounded by invisible tormentors. We had not gotten far before Amal had to stop because his boot was coming apart. We waited while he wrapped mending tape around it,
but that lasted only half an hour before the sole of his boot was flapping free again.
"I've got to stop and fix this, or my foot will freeze," he said.
We were all a little grateful to have an excuse to set up the tent and stop our struggle to continue. Once inside, we found that all of our cold suits were pierced with small cuts and pinholes. We spent some time repairing them, then looked at each other to see who wanted to continue.
"What happens if we camp while Umber is in the sky and only travel by day?"
Edie finally asked. I did a quick calculation. It would add another 300 hours. We don't have food to last.
"If we keep going, our cold suits will be cut to ribbons," Davern said.
"If only we could see what's attacking us," Edie exclaimed.
Softly, Seabird said,
"It's ghosts."
We all fell silent. I looked at her, expecting it was some sort of joke. But she was deadly serious.
"All those people who died," she said.
At home, everyone would have laughed and mocked her. Out here, no one replied. I pulled up the hood of my cold suit and rose.
"Where are you going?" Davern said. "I want to check out the look-through trees. In reality, I wanted some silence to think."
"What a time to be botanizing," Davern exclaimed.
"Shut up, Davern," Amal said.
Outside, in the empty waste, I had a feeling of being watched. I shook it off. When we had camped, I had noticed that a nearby grove of look-through trees was glowing in the dark, shades of blue and green. I picked my way across the rocks toward them. I suspected that the fluorescence was an adaptation that allowed them to survive the hostile conditions of Umber Night. And I wanted some samples. When I reached the grove and examined one of the long, flat leaves under lamplight, it looked transparent, as usual. Shutting my lamp off, I held it up and looked through it. With a start, I pressed it to my visor so I could see through the leaf. What looked like a rocky waste by the dim starlight was suddenly a brightly lit landscape, and everywhere I looked, the land bloomed with organic shapes unlike any I'd ever seen. Under a rock by my feet was a low, domed mound pierced with holes like an overturned colander glowing from within. Beneath the everlives were breadloaf-shaped growths covered with plates that slid aside as I watched to expose a hummocked mound inside. There were things with leathery rinds that folded out like petals to collect the unlight, which snapped shut the instant I turned on my lamp. In between the larger life forms, the ground was crawling with smaller, insect-sized things, and in the distance, I could see gauzy curtains held up by gas bladders floating on the wind. An entire alternate biota had sprung to life in Umberlight. Dust was not just the barren place we saw by day, but a thriving dual ecosystem, half of which had been waiting as spores or seeds in the soil to be awakened by Umber's radiation. I knelt down to see why they had been so invisible. By our light, some of them were transparent as glass. Others were so black, they blended in with the rock. By Umber light, they lit up in bright colors, reflecting a spectrum we could not see. I looked down at the leaf that had given me new sight. It probably had a microstructure that converted high-energy radiation into the visible spectrum so the tree could continue to absorb the milder wavelengths. Quickly, I plucked a handful of the leaves. Holding one to my visor, I turned back toward the tent. The UV-reflecting fabric was a dull gray in our light. but umber light made it shine like a beacon, the brightest thing in the landscape. I looked down at my cold suit, and it also glowed like a torch. The things of umber night might be invisible to us, but we were all too visible to them. When I came back into the tent, my companions were still arguing. Silently, I handed each of them a strip of leaf. Davern threw his away in disgust.
"What's this? Some sort of peace offering?" he said.
"Put on your cold suits and come outside," I said. "Hold the leaves up to your faceplates and look through them." Their reactions, when they saw the reality around us, were as different as they were. Astonished, uneasy, disbelieving. Seabird was terrified and shrank back toward the tent.
"It's like nightmares," she said.
Edie put an arm around her.
"It's better than ghosts," she said. "No, it's not. It's the shadow side of all the living beings. That's why we couldn't see them."
"We couldn't see them because they don't reflect the spectrum of light our eyes absorb," Amal said reasonably.
Seabird did not look comforted. I looked ahead, down the road we needed to take. Umber was bright as an anti-sun. In its light, the land was not empty, but full. There was a boil of emerging life in every crack of the landscape, just not our sort of life. We were the strangers here, the fruits that had fallen too far from the tree. We did not belong. You would think that being able to see the obstacles would speed us up, but not so. We were skittish now. With strips of look-through leaves taped to our visors, we could see both worlds, which were the same world, but we could not tell the harmless from the harmful. So we treated it all as a threat, dodging, detouring, clearing the road with a shovel when we could. As we continued, the organisms changed and multiplied fast around us, as if their growth were an overdrive. It was spring for them, and they were sprouting and spawning. What would they look like fully grown? I hoped not to find out. I can't describe the life forms of umber night in biological language, because I couldn't tell if I was looking at a plant, animal, or something in between. We quickly discovered what had been piercing our cold suits, a plant-like thing shaped like a scorpion with a spring-loaded tail lined with barbs. When triggered by our movement, it would release a shower of pin-sharp projectiles. Perhaps they were poison, and our incompatible proteins protected us. The road had sprouted all manner of creatures covered with plates and shells, little ziggurats and stepped pyramids, spirals and domes. In between them floated bulbs like amber airborne eggplants. They spurted a mucus that ate away any plastic it touched. We topped a rise to find the valley before us completely crusted over with life, and no trace of a path. No longer could we avoid trampling through it, crushing it underfoot. Ahead, a translucent curtain, suspended from floating, gas-filled bladders, hung across our path. It shimmered with iridescent unlight.
"It's rather beautiful, isn't it?" Edie said.
"Yes. But is it dangerous?"
Amal said.
"We're not prey," Anatoly argued. "This life can't get any nutrients from us."
"I doubt it knows that," I said. "It might just act on instinct."
"We could send the dog to find out,"
Anatoly suggested. Sally showed no inclination. Edie had put her on a leash, but it was hardly necessary. She was constantly alert now, on guard.
"Go around it," I advised.
So we left our path to detour across land where the boulders had become hard to spot amid the riot of life. As Bucky's wheels crushed the shell of one dome, I saw that inside it was a wriggling mass of larvae. It was not a single organism, but a colony. That would explain how such complex structures came about so fast. They were just hives of smaller organisms. We cleared a place to camp by trampling down the undergrowth and shoveling it out of the way. Exhausted as we were, it was still hard to sleep through the sounds from outside. Buzzing, whooshing, scratching, scrabbling. My brain kept coming back to one thought. At this rate, our return would take twice as long as the journey out. The tent was cold when we woke. Our heater had failed. When Amal unfastened the tent flap, he gave an uncharacteristically profane exclamation. The opening was entirely blocked by undergrowth. No longer cautious, we set about hacking and smashing our way out, disturbing hordes of tiny crawling things. When we had cleared a path and turned back to look, we saw that the tent was surrounded by mounds of organisms, attracted by its reflected light. The heater had failed because its air intake was blocked. Bucky parked several yards away, had not attracted the umber life. It was the coldest part of night, but umber was high in the sky, and the life forms had speeded up. We marched in formation now, with three fanned out in front to scan for obstructions, one in the center with Bucky, and two bringing up the rear. I was out in front with Seabird and Davern when we reached a hilltop and saw that the way ahead was blocked by a lake that had not been there on the way out. We gathered to survey it. It was white, like an ocean of milk. "What is it?" Edie asked. "Not water," Anatoly said. "It's too cold for that. Too warm for methane." I could not see any waves, but there was an ebb and flow around the edges. "Wait here. I want to get closer," I said. Amal and Anatoly wouldn't let me go alone, so the three of us set out. We were nearly on the beach edge, before we could see it clearly. Amal came to an abrupt halt. "Spiders," he said, repulsed. "It's a sea of spiders." They were not spiders, of course, but that is the closest analog. Long-legged, crawling things, entirely white in the umber light. At the edges of the sea, they were tiny, but farther out, we could see ones the size of Sally, all seemingly competing to get toward the center of the mass. There must have been a hatching while we had slept. "That is truly disgusting," Anatoly said. I gave a humorless laugh. "I've read about this on other planets. Wildlife covering the land. The accounts always say it's a majestic, inspiring sight." "Umber turns everything into its evil twin," Amal said. As we stood there, a change was taking place. A wave was gathering far out. The small fry in front of us were scattering to get out of the way as it swept closer.
"They're coming toward us," Anatoly said.
We turned to run back toward the hill where we had left our friends. Anatoly and Amal reached the hilltop before I did. Edie shouted a warning, and I turned to see a knee-high spider on my heels, its pale body like a skull on legs. I had no weapon but my flashlight, so I nailed it with a light beam. To my surprise, it recoiled onto its hind legs, waving its front legs in the air. It gave me time to reach the others.
"They're repelled by light," I shouted. "Form a line and shine them off."
The wave of spiders surged up the hill, but we kept them at bay with our lights. They circled us, and we ended up in a ring around Bucky, madly sweeping our flashlights to and fro to keep them off, while Sally barked from behind us. Far across the land, the horizon lit with a silent flash like purple lightning. The spiders paused, then turned mindlessly toward this new light source. As quickly as they had swarmed toward us, they were swarming away. We watched the entire lake of them drain, heading toward some signal we could not see.
"Quick, let's cross while they're gone," I said.
We dashed as fast as we could across the plain where they had gathered. From time to time, we saw other flashes of unlight, always far away, and never followed by thunder. In our haste, we let our vigilance lapse, and one of Bucky's wheels thunked into a pothole. The other wheels spun, throwing up loose dirt and digging themselves in. I called out, "Bucky, stop!" But he was already stuck fast.
"Let's push him out,"
Amal said, but I held up a hand. The buggy was already dangerously tilted. "We're going to have to unload some crates to lighten him up and dig that wheel out." Everyone looked nervously in the direction where the spiders had gone, but Amal said,
"Okay, you dig. We'll unload."
We all set to work. I was so absorbed in freeing Bucky's wheel that I did not see the danger approaching until Seabird gave a cry of warning. I looked up to see one of the gauzy curtains bearing down on us from windward. It was yards wide, big enough to envelop us all, and twinkling with a spiderweb of glowing threads.
"Run!"
Amal shouted. I dropped my shovel and fled. Behind me, I heard Edie's voice crying, "Sally!" and Amal saying,
"No, Edie, leave her be."
I whirled around and saw that the dog had taken refuge under the buggy. Edie was running back to get her. Amal was about to head back for Edie, so I dived at his legs and brought him down with a thud. From the ground, we both watched as Edie gave up and turned back toward us. Behind her, the curtain that had been sweeping toward Bucky changed direction, veering straight for Edie.
"Edie!"
Amal screamed. She turned, saw her danger, and froze. The curtain enveloped her, wrapping her tight in an immobilizing net. There was a sudden, blinding flash of combustion. As I blinked the afterspots away, I saw the curtain float on, shredded now, leaving behind a charcoal pillar in the shape of a woman. Motionless with shock, I gazed at that black statue standing out against the eastern sky. It was several seconds before I realized that the sky was growing bright. Beyond all of us, dawn was coming.